Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. I am so delighted that you're with us tonight. It's time for me to dunk you all in our legal goo. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and I take no responsibility for them. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity for WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you get upset about something that you hear on Trisha's True Crime Radio, don't blame it on the websites. You come to me, darling, and we will see what we can do for you. Our guest tonight is Jennifer Dobner. Jennifer is writing about the murder trial of Dr. Martin McNeil for the Deseret News. And also with us is my official, unofficial co-host, Michael from Minnesota. And basically, this is one of the most bizarre murder trials we have run across, and we have run across a lot of strange ones, let me tell you. Dr. Martin McNeil is charged with killing his wife in 2007. Basically, the real bare bones basic of the story is the doctor prescribed drugs, painkillers after his wife's surgery for a facelift, and then according to prosecutors, he drowned her in the bathtub. Now, the original autopsy said she died of heart disease, but thanks to Michelle McNeil's daughters who pushed to get the case reopened, it was finally ruled a homicide. Prosecutors say the motive for the murder is a woman named Gypsy Willis, no relation to Bruce that we know of. Now, I have jumped all over some big chunks here. We'll get down to those details in just a little bit, because these details read like an overdramatic Lifetime television for chicks who like true crime movie script. This is so bizarre, and it would be almost, I don't want to say laughable, but if it wasn't so tragic and absolutely disgusting, it would be something that we might find a bit entertaining, but it isn't, because there are lives involved here, young lives that have been destroyed because of this maniac. Our guest tonight, Jennifer Dobner, reporting for the Deseret News. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Jennifer, where'd you go? Whoops, hold on.
Can you hear me?
Jennifer, I can hear you now. I don't know what happened. That was weird.
Can you hear me now? Sorry.
I can hear you now.
That's what happened. Thanks.
That was my fault. Jennifer, give us just a little bit of background, okay?
On myself?
Yes, please.
I've been a reporter for about 22 years. I spent the last 15 here in Salt Lake City. I worked for the Deseret News when I first came here in 97, and then I went on to work for the San Diego Union-Tribune, spent 7.5 years at the Associated Press, and last year I was working for the Salt Lake Tribune. Now I'm a freelance writer.
Fantastic. So, boy, you know your stuff. That's a good thing. And I've really been very impressed, and so have a lot of people, with your articles about this case. Let's just kind of go back to the beginning, and so we can get some background here before we jump into the actual trial itself. They were a gorgeous couple. I mean, the Deseret News did a great article in 2007 that really kind of brought everything home, and it showed this picture of Michelle and the good doctor, McNeil. It showed this picture, and they were just a gorgeous couple, absolutely gorgeous.
They were a gorgeous couple, and they had a beautiful family of 8 kids, the youngest 4 of whom were all adopted from the Ukraine.
And what happened? When did things start going sour? Because it seems to me, first of all, let's talk about the doctor himself. He presented himself as this, you know, kind of incredibly smart, normal, great dad, when in reality he was anything but. What do we know about his background?
We know that he went to both law school and medical school. Mm-hmm. It appears that there has been some fabrication of transcripts or some sort of school records that got him admitted to both law school and medical school. He got a license to practice medicine in Utah and was working as the clinical director of the Utah Developmental Center, which is in American Fork, which is a residential facility for people with severe disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that is where he was working at the time that Michelle died in 2007. What we found out since her death is that there had been a series of infidelities in the marriage. He had had several affairs, And as prosecutors said in court this week, the case, this particular case, really starts about 18 months before her death, when he started having a relationship with this Gypsy Willis person. First, it was just a friendship and email exchanges and a few lunches, and then later in the relationship, it became sexual.
Please continue.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, this guy, I mean, the things he has done, four of the daughters were adopted.
Yes.
Didn't he take one back to the Ukraine and just dump her and leave her? Tell us that story.
What I know about that is that in July of 2007, Giselle was her name, or is her name. She was 16 years old, and Martin McNeil took her to the Ukraine to visit some biological relatives. And Alexis, her older sister, who's one of the biological children of Martin and Michelle, contends that Giselle was told if she didn't go and stay, that he would not let her see her younger siblings ever again. Alexis was told if she didn't go with Giselle to the Ukraine, then she would be prevented from seeing her younger siblings again. Giselle was taken there. She was left there with family, and Alexis was asked to bring her passport home so that Giselle would not lose it, and those were Martin's words. He and Gypsy later used that passport to get a fake, a false identity for Gypsy, and that's the federal crime for which, federal identity theft crime for which both of them have served time.
Continue.
And that was just one of many, correct?
Yeah.
He was in prison for more than just that particular identity theft.
He served time years ago for forgery and theft, and it was about the time that he married Michelle in, I believe, 1978. He did some time, and I'm not sure where he served, but he did some time in 1978. I believe it was 6 months in a county jail. Although it may have been a prison because it was a felony charge. Anyway, but he went to medical school while he was on probation. He went to medical school in Mexico, and then they returned to California before coming to Utah.
So but he was in jail before he met Michelle, right? Didn't he have some problems? Because I'm just wondering why in the heck she married this guy.
Well, that's a good question. He'd actually served time for the forgery charges and the theft charges after they were married, and it was about 6 month sentence. And then he was on probation. And that was sort of a catch-me-if-you-can sort of scheme in which he stole, I believe, some credit cards and then used them to, buy a bunch of stuff that he didn't need. And he claimed that he did it because he just wanted to see if he could do it. So, but her family has
from a 60 Minutes episode. He saw a 60 Minutes episode about identity theft and thought he could do it better and never get caught.
That is what he said. But her family has said that, she fell hard for him, that he was charming and handsome, and that, they didn't really like him. And they are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormon Church. And her ecclesiastical leader, who's known as a bishop, basically told her mother that, he was sort of a suspect character, and he didn't really think Michelle should go out with him, but she fell hard, and maybe in part because, her family didn't approve.
A bad guy. He was a bad boy. That's one thing that we women really know how to do, is pick the ones our families don't like.
Yeah, and they eloped, it was after the elopement the family found out, and Michelle found out that he had forged this $35,000 in checks for this spending spree. And so Michelle's mother was, you know, very, very uncomfortable with this, and about 31 years ago actually said to her sisters that she wouldn't be surprised if Martin killed Michelle someday.
Oh, wow. Ooh, talk about that. You know, you say that, but you wonder if you really, really believe it. That's, oh, that poor woman. So, okay, so now she's married to a bad boy, and we know this. And obviously, mm-hmm. he's the type of guy that, and I don't know if this will be brought up in court or not, but I'm assuming he's had other affairs other than Gypsy Willis. Do we know about that? Is that correct?
We know that there are two or three, I can't recall the exact number, and we know that at least one of those people will be testifying in court next week or the week after. And I'm not quite familiar with what she's going to say, but, mm-hmm. Yeah, we do know that there have been other affairs. But the relationship with Gypsy apparently is what became far more serious.
So that's kind of, the prosecution is saying that's the catalyst for the murder. That's what.
Right.
Well, there were also accusations of rape too against the doctor.
There were accusations of rape, of professional misconduct, of misdiagnosis, and some other improprieties when he was working part time at a clinic at Brigham Young, at the health clinic at Brigham Young University. There in Provo. That's at the time that he was going to law school. He's going to school part-time and law school part-time and working part-time.
Was anything ever happened? Was he ever charged?
No charges ever came out of those allegations. He was dismissed, fired by the health center, but they don't give a reason for that. It's a personnel matter, they say, and so there's no specific information provided.
So in other words, and this is my opinion, and I'm not suggesting that you're saying this, but this guy is just a real dirtbag, let's face it. He's one of these scam artists, probably some sort of sociopath, or in the sociopath family, if you will. And Michelle, this sweet, kind woman, falls hard for him. They have 8 kids, 4 are adopted. He has affairs off and on. And now he meets Gypsy Willis. How did Martin McNeil, Dr. Martin McNeil, meet Gypsy Willis?
Well,
on a porno site. On a porno site.
Did they really?
Yeah.
You know,
it was,
you know,
in
what?
A porno chat.
I actually don't know the answer to the question. But they, what I do know is that they initially, you know, talked online, and then
They talked online. I didn't hear anything about the porno chat. Wow.
I've not heard anything about the porno thing either.
Yeah, I've read it several places by different sources. And Michelle had caught Martin on numerous occasions on these pornographic sites. And
he had been looking at porn.
I knew that.
And had threatened to leave him, and he always threatened suicide if she ever would leave him. The couple's house was in Michelle's name, probably because of his past
mm-hmm.
brushes with the law. And after she died, this gypsy pretended to be Michelle and turned the title of the home over to Martin so that there wouldn't be a problem. So that was another. They forged those documents. That was another.
Another charge.
That was another reason he was just in prison.
Right. So he had done that. She had done that and gave it to him so there wouldn't be any issue with getting, you know, having to go through probate and getting the, you know, deed turned over to him and blah, blah, blah. She just pretended to be Michelle. I mean, this guy is a piece of work. Okay, so I want to tell everyone who we're talking with. We're talking with Jennifer Dobner. Jennifer is reporting for the Deseret News on the Dr. Martin McNeil trial happening in Salt Lake City, my hometown. And this guy is just, I'm telling you, you wouldn't believe it. If somebody brought a fictional story, a fictional script, and said, I want to make this movie, you would say, this is just too ridiculous. Nobody would believe it. But this is what is happening. He's charged with killing his wife. They've adopted 8 kids, or excuse me, have 8 kids. 4 of them are adopted. At first, her death was ruled accidental, or actually it was just heart disease, if I'm not mistaken. And then because of Michelle's daughters, it was reopened, and they went, hey, he gave her way too many painkillers, and there's something really fishy going on here. Okay, Jennifer, so he meets Gypsy, and apparently mm-hmm. Gypsy is somebody like nobody else he's ever met before. Do you know much about her? Do we know what her deal is here?
No, I don't know much about her. We're expecting to hear her on the stand this coming week, possibly mm-hmm. Friday, I'm told. So I'm anxious to hear what she has to say. I know that she was living with some roommates at the time that she was seeing Martin. There are some reports that she may have told those roommates that Martin were plotting to kill Michelle, and that how they were going to make that look like it was an accident. Interestingly enough, though, he brought her into the home within a couple of weeks of Michelle's death, introducing her first as a nanny, telling the neighbors she would be the nanny, and then we heard on the stand this week that it became, clear to the neighbors quite quickly that there was more than just that going on in the house.
I read, too, where he had taken his daughter, Alexis, to the church, and they
yes.
had prayed to God for a nanny, and then
yes.
they had arranged for this Gypsy to just
right.
miraculously appear on the steps of the church where they supposedly
right.
just met when they had been having this sexual affair. And
yeah.
it was like he put it off as an act of God that brought Gypsy into the family's life.
Yes, and we also heard this last week on the stand that about 6 months before Michelle's death, he had approached another neighbor in their little sort of development that they lived in American Fork, or Pleasant Grove, rather, that a nursing student that he knew of was looking for a place to live. And there's a professional baseball player that lives in the neighborhood who spends about 6 months out of the year away, and he asked the neighbor if she thought they would be open to having a house sitter for a window of time. So he tried to move her into the neighborhood about 6 months before Michelle passed away or was killed, and allegedly killed, I should say. It hasn't been proven yet. And the neighbor declined. So we know that he was quite serious about a relationship with this woman. And you're right, it was about 3 days after Michelle's death that he and Alexis, I believe, or Rachel, rather, went to the temple, Mormon temple, and to pray, and Rachel and Alexis kept telling their father that they didn't really need a nanny, that between them they could do it, and other family they could take care of the younger girls, and it wasn't really necessary, but he was insistent. And so they leave the temple, and they're outside, and Gypsy walks by, and it is apparently a completely staged meeting where he says, I think I recognize you from somewhere, and then, within weeks after that encounter, she's in the home. And Rachel and Alexis recognize her name and object to her being the nanny because they believe she's the woman that their father was having an affair with.
Wow. That, to me, the fact that he went to that trouble 6 months before to try and get her in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
you have to wonder if Michelle suspected all along that this person was, that he was trying to bring in.
Oh, she knew all about her.
She knew about her.
And I'm not clear about how soon before her death she learned of her. I know that she had been looking at the phone records and saw, a history of frequent telephone calls to the number that belongs to Gypsy, mm-hmm. for the phone that Gypsy had, and that she had challenged Martin on this, and that they had argued about this. And we know that Alexis and I believe also Rachel were aware that their mother had been talking to their father about, or at least accused him of having an affair.
But I'm wondering what my wandering mind is asking: how long before she died did she figure out that this one was somebody that he was really serious about?
Yeah,
when did she
it was
really?
Very long.
I don't think. Yeah.
But you do have to wonder. I think about the decision to have a facelift. She's 50 years old. You know, many of us, as we reach middle age, become uncomfortable with how aging is manifesting on our faces and on our bodies. And she, you know, if you have to wonder if the affair was motivation at all for her to inquire about a facelift, because it is the facelift surgery that, you know, precipitated her death.
I read where it was Martin's suggestion and his insistence that she get the facelift.
Well, but yeah, but it was her decision ultimately, and I know that too, that he was the one that said, you know, yes, you need a facelift, and I'm just trying to put myself in Michelle's shoes. It's like, okay, my husband's having an affair, I'm 50 years old, and he's telling me to get a facelift. Okay, I guess I should get a facelift. You know, it's like that probably had something to do with the fact that he wanted it, he was having an affair, and she probably felt incredibly insecure.
So the plastic surgeon, Dr. Thompson, testified on Thursday, and he said that his conversation with Michelle was that she was uncomfortable and with the aging process and did not like the way that she looked and that she wanted the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
He recommended, because she had high blood pressure and he just recommended that and was experiencing some depression. She told him she was experiencing some depression. That he recommended that she could put it off for a while and get her blood pressure under control and, you know, see how the depression medication, if she felt better. But, I mean, and he said he had that conversation with Martin and that they both agreed that that might be an option, but then ultimately they went ahead with the surgery. You know, nobody's inside really, you know, their house having the conversation, you know, standing there to hear the conversation. So decisions were made and, you know, we're going to hear testimony in court of who thinks who said what to whom. But it may be that only two people really know and one of them is no longer here to tell us.
Exactly.
I understood that Alexis was privy to a lot of the conversation.
You know, she was a medical student and down in the Las Vegas area, and she had been to some of the doctor's appointments and was home at the time of the surgery and was caring for her mother, helping care for her mother.
Right.
So, you know, we're expecting
the day before
she's next week.
Oh, she'll be on dynamite.
Yeah, because
witness, I believe.
Because the mom was saying, she talked to her mom. Her mom was saying, I'm feeling good. You know, I'm down to, what, one Loratap a day, and I'm going to go pick up Ada. I feel, you know, she was doing great. There was no reason for her to die.
And that's what Dr. Thompson
the only
said
reason,
as well.
That's the only reason Alexis left home to go back to Las Vegas.
Right.
Because she had taken her mother to her post-op an appointment. And the doctor was so impressed with how well she was doing. There was no reason for her to overdose on any medications.
Exactly.
Given how that post-operative appointment went.
Yeah.
That's why Alexis sounded the suspicion bell right away. Because
she
Alexis
did.
Had found her mother the day before she died.
Day after surgery.
It was the day before she died. Because she had had conversations with her the night before, and her dad insisted she go to bed and get some sleep. And when she checked on her mother the next morning, she couldn't arouse her. She was so deeply medicated. So,
yeah, and it was shortly after that Michelle asked Alexis to just, you know, put the pills in her hand so that she could feel them and understand identify them so that she knew what it was she was taking if someone other than Alexis were giving her the pills.
Right.
Now here's another thing that's interesting. The doctor who did the surgery on Michelle wanted her to spend the night in the hospital. Said you got to spend the night.
And she did.
She did. Well, the doctor, her husband was saying, no, she's got to come home. She's got to come. It was like he wanted to grab her and get her home as quick as possible, which is very strange for a doctor, because you would think he would want her to stay there too And that's what's weird. That's another thing. And there's so many things in this case that this doctor did to raise suspicion and alarm. And Alexis, being smart and loving her mother, fortunately saw these warning signs and will be able to help. But I'm sure she feels, I can't imagine what she must be feeling now, knowing that as soon as she left, her mother was killed. But, you know, what could she do? She didn't think her father would go to that length. I mean, for God's sakes, it's just such a mess. And so many people have been absolutely tormented by this man. Let's talk, I'm sorry, who took a big breath? Somebody was going to say something.
It was me. Jennifer, when the doctor was on the stand, mm-hmm. I had read some summation that said he almost asked the doctor, Dr. Martin, to leave from the visit because he was monopolizing and asking questions. Was that?
Mm-hmm. At one point during one of the visits, Martin, who by all accounts has a very exuberant personality, and was answering a lot of questions for Michelle. To put it in a cultural context, there are a lot of in Mormon culture, a lot of relationships in which the husband is the more dominant personality and does more of the talking. So that doesn't strike me necessarily as suspicious. But Dr. Thompson did ask Martin to leave the room so he could speak to Michelle privately, and that's when Michelle told him that the reason that she wanted the facelift in part was because she didn't feel good about how she looked as she was aging and that she had been sad recently and feeling depressed. And and Dr. Thompson didn't express that he had any hesitation about going forward with the surgery after having talked to Michelle. He makes those decisions, I guess, in conjunction with patients every day. And at the time, it doesn't appear that anything struck him as particularly unusual.
Let's take us to the morning that Michelle was found in the bathtub. Now, that was the morning, mm-hmm. if I understand correctly, that Michelle was going to pick up Ada from school. And mm-hmm. somehow it ended up that Dr. McNeil picked up Ada. And they're thinking, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the doctor was supposed to go to some safety fair. And
he did attend safety fair.
He did, but it was just to receive an award, right? And then
mm-hmm.
he left. There's some unaccounted time that I am assuming the prosecution is going to say this is when he did it. But he picked up his daughter from school and let her. How old was Ada when he picked her up?
Ada was 6 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. I think they were going to a private school because there's been some testimony about her being dressed in her school uniform at the time that she went to get help from the neighbors. We haven't heard the prosecution's timetable. The defense has filed a notice of an alibi defense that says that Martin went to work. Dr. McNeil went to work. I shouldn't call him a doctor. He surrendered his license in Utah 2009. So
okay.
McNeil went to work between 6 and 7 in the morning. He returned home at some point, picked up his two youngest daughters, took them to school. He was back at work by 9 o'clock. The safety fair was at the developmental center. It started at 11. At 11:15, there was an award ceremony in which he was given some sort of award and had his picture taken, and then mm-hmm. and then left to pick up Ada from school at about 11:30, and then the 911 call was at about 12:54 or 12:58. I can't remember the exact time, but it was in that window, within 10 minutes to, or, pardon me, 11:58 or 11. 50, around right before noon. And so they contend that phone records, both from the developmental center and from Martin's cell phone, will show you that he wasn't at home that morning. And the neighbors also testified. They have a shared driveway with the neighbor just to the north of them, I believe. And she said that she did not see anyone going from the house that day. she was home and didn't see anybody coming and going.
Has the prosecution, and maybe you don't, hold on, Michael, I have a thought here, and it's rarely that I have a thought that I'm proud of, and this one I am. So I'll let you go next.
I can't believe that that's true, but go ahead.
Okay. Let's say that the doctor can provide an eyewitness hardcore alibi.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't the prosecution then look at Gypsy and say, well, she had to do it, and where was she? I'm assuming they've cleared her. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. She is testifying for the prosecution. I'm not clear if she plans to implicate him or not.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't charge her, though. They've charged him. And although I will say this, her death has never been ruled a homicide. It has been called undetermined, manner of death undetermined, and suspicious. But it's never been ruled a homicide, and that's from three medical examiners.
Okay. For some reason, I thought suspicious / homicide. I thought that's how it went, but it's not. So,
no,
okay.
Todd Gray is the Utah State medical examiner. He is the second person from his office to he's the second person from Utah who looked at the case. Maureen Fricke did the first autopsy, and she, you know, determined it was natural causes and related to, you know, two different kinds of heart disease that Michelle suffered from. The level of toxicity from the four drugs that were in her system was not determined to be, abnormally high. I mean, the combination of them could have been lethal, but they were not off the charts amounts. So the first autopsy was done in 2007, shortly after her death, and it took the prosecutors more than 2 years, almost 3 years, to get Todd Gray to reopen the case and look at it. And even then, he only made slight changes into the findings of Maureen Fricke's original autopsy. And he's the one who said, okay, undetermined manner of death and some, you know, and suspicious. But it was the third medical examiner is an expert from Florida who is the person who concluded that she drowned. But those were not the findings in Utah.
I know Go ahead, Michael.
Wasn't it Alexis or the daughters who went
yeah.
for the third autopsy and had their mother exhumed?
I don't believe she was exhumed, but she may have been. But it was the girls who were very suspicious and, you know, sort of kept on the prosecutors and kept on the county investigators to, you know, keep digging and keep digging and keep digging.
I know
now,
people
Jennifer,
who have...
I have a question.
Go,
mm-hmm.
go ahead.
Go ahead.
Michael, go ahead. No, you go.
Okay.
You go.
I'm sorry.
You're fine.
Something that drives me the craziest in these trials is the stuff or the evidence that the judge rules is too prejudicial and doesn't allow into court. Did you follow this case through the pretrial motion, and do you know of what evidence has been ruled too prejudicial that the jury will never hear?
I was not covering the case then, but I know that there have been some pieces. I'm looking through my notes here to see if I can quickly identify what they are. Oh, okay. So there's two people there are some people testifying who are inmates who can't be identified publicly, and they can't be photographed. There's been some pressure from the media to open up some sealed documents, and those have been denied. There's also been information about Alexis and her particular mental health issues, which the judge has not ruled on yet, whether or not her mental health records can be issued in the case. And I don't see that I have, I'm looking for a piece of paper that I can't find, I'm sorry, about certain things about Mr. McNeil's criminal past that are not going to be allowed into the case. also.
Because I hope they go to show that he has a complete lack of character for all of his crimes, as far as even just the turning of the deed over to himself after his wife was dead, changing
yeah.
his will, only leave a dollar to each child, and having
mm-hmm.
the rest go to Gypsy. I mean, on and on. We could just go on and on and on with this case.
I
but
think
I was
of,
thinking
many
to myself,
those,
I wonder if any of this will be stricken or not allowed.
I believe that many of those things have been challenged by the defense, and a good chunk of them have been ruled inadmissible because they, in the defense's point of view, don't have any bearing on the particular case at hand.
I just wanted to say that the gentleman at that did the second autopsy, Todd Gray.
Todd Gray. Mm-hmm.
I know people who work with him. I've never met him, and they say he is top notch, excellent.
Yes.
And they not a bad thing to say about him. So I just throwing
yeah.
that out there for information's sake. He's just apparently a very, very well thought of, very hardworking, and very highly intelligent person,
and
is good at what he does.
And highly regarded. Yeah, highly regarded by law enforcement and in the legal community here. I've been covering trials here for 15 years, and he is a frequent expert testifying in court, and he has an impeccable record.
Let's talk about that. Yes, he does. Let's talk about that morning.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to pick up Ada after he's been to the safety fair, and that's
mm-hmm.
going to be his alibi.
Right.
Ada runs up and discovers her mother. Tell us the series of events, Jennifer Dobner, with writing for the Deseret News. Tell us the series of events that happened as soon as 6-year-old Ada found her mother unconscious in the bathtub.
So what we know is that Ada went and found her and then called her father, that he came into the room and told her to run to the neighbors and get some help. At that point, he calls 911, and again, it was just before noon that he made the call. And Ada goes next door, and so they played the 911 tape on Friday, I should say. And so he calls 911, and he sounds quite frantic. He's yelling. They can't quite understand what he wants. He gives them an address. He either hangs up or gets disconnected. 911 calls him back. He says his wife is underwater. She's in the tub. She's underwater. He's letting the water out of the tub, and he's trying to get her. He's trying to start CPR on her, but he needs help. He needs help. She's not breathing, and he needs help. Meanwhile, Ada has run next door. So three of the neighbors testified that were involved that day, testified in court on Thursday and Friday. The first woman is the woman who lives to the north who has the shared driveway. She said Ada came to her front door and was very calm. She was dressed in her school uniform, and all she said was, "My dad needs some help." And so the neighbor goes, it's a woman, she goes next door. I'm drawing a blank on her name, and I can't figure out why. Daniels, Christy Daniels.
It was
Daniels.
Vicky, wasn't it? Oh, I thought it was
No,
Vicky.
Christy Daniels was the first person to testify. She
oh,
had
that's great.
She had a couple of other moms at her house, and they were having sort of like a play date for their kids. So there were some kids in the home and three women. And Christy runs next door with Ada, and she testified on Friday that she could hear Martin screaming before she even got to the front door. And their houses are pretty close together, and again, they have a shared driveway, so she could hear him while she was still in the driveway. The front door was open. She went into the house, and she sort of followed his voice until she could she got to the bedroom, and she went into the bathroom, and she could see Michelle in the tub. She was only clothed from the waist up. She was sort of slumped in the tub, and it's sort of an oval-shaped, sort of deep tub, sunken, sort of like a sunken tub. The pictures that were shown in court show it sort of mounted, you know, in some bathrooms they sort of, like there's a little step up to the bathtub, and then the bathtub is deep. And that's how, and they did bring a bathtub into court on Friday. I don't know if you saw that in the news stories, but they brought
yes.
a tub in to use as a demonstrative sort of tool. it is not the tub that was that she was in. It is a tub that is similar to the tub that was in the home. It's made by the same manufacturer. So anyway, she sees Michelle in the tub, and she can see that about that the crown of her head is sticking up over the rim of the tub, and then her feet are in, and her knees are sort of up, and she's sort of slumped down, and Martin is yelling, you know, I need help, I need help. He says he needs a man to help him get her out, because Michelle at this point is 180 pounds, and mm-hmm. to reach over and, you know, lift that kind of weight up, he thought he needed a man to help him. So she said she would call 911. Christy says, I'll call 911.
Did you say 180? I'm sorry, Jennifer. Did you say 100? And...
Yeah.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. She looked much slighter than that.
Well, I think pictures we've seen of her are quite are from when she was much younger. So, and the prosecution said, the defense said, I can't remember if it was Thursday or Friday, they brought up her weight. That she was 180 pounds. Christy Daniels testified that she ran next door to get one of the other moms and also called her husband, who was not at work that day and was at another neighbor's house helping them with something. So he was just, like, on the other side of the – it's sort of a circle with a park in the middle of the street that they live on. So he was, like, on the mm-hmm. other side of the park at a house on the other side of the circle. So she calls him, Doug, and he comes and runs to the McNeil's house, and he helps Martin get her out of the tub. And they get her, Doug lifted her from underneath her knees, and Martin lifted her from the top underneath her arms, put her on the ground, and then they began to try to do CPR.
With Vicky starting the chest compressions, and then Martin supplying the oxygen.
Yeah, Christy started the chest compressions, and Martin was supposed to be blowing puffs of air into Michelle's mouth. It is not clear whether he did or didn't do it. The prosecution contends that he did not.
And are
I
there
agree.
Going to be three witnesses? Are there going to be, like, three witnesses saying that he did not? I think they're going to have, a bunch of people come forward and say he was not.
So Angie, the three witnesses, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say when help arrived, the paramedics, they mm-hmm. started, they took over CPR, and it was them, after they started blowing in her mouth and doing chest compressions, they heard gurgling in her lungs,
right.
and then she expelled water. So if Martin had been doing it properly, which as a doctor he certainly would know how, that action would have happened far before, because it took 30 minutes for the paramedics to arrive from reports I read.
He would have.
Because he gave us the wrong address.
Actually,
yeah, and
when
they
you slow it down, when you slow down the 911 recording, he does give the right address, because the defense played it in a slowed down form, and you can hear it is the right address. When you hear the 911 call, he sounds very frantic. I mean, most of us would be frantic when we were calling 911 in that type of situation, and he is yelling, and he. Is very agitated in the call, but he does, when you slow it down, he does give the right address. They could not hear him, and they had to use their computer system in order to sort of figure it out. He called from a cell phone, so they couldn't, track it by the landline. They sent, and it was actually two police officers that got in there first. They arrived ahead of paramedics and the ambulance. One of them also testified on Friday. She apparently had some mucus on her face, and there was a much made of whether or not Martin had transferred to Martin's face or whether or not he had wiped it away before he started blowing puffs of it,
mm-hmm.
his portion of the CPR. So, and no one could say whether or not they saw her chest rise. Including
right.
the police officer could not say whether or not when they were doing CPR, whether or not her chest was going up and down. So, and much was made of that as well, because the prosecution contends that he lied about it and didn't actually do it.
Right.
Let's talk about briefly about the things he was yelling. He was acting, and to me this is just an act. Wasn't he saying something like, why did you do this to me? Or just being incredibly over-dramatic in the yelling and the dancing around. Why don't you speak to that a moment, Jennifer?
Yes. You can sort of imagine it, I guess, when you hear him yelling, the frantic yelling on the 911 call. He was yelling, you know, you don't hear that on 911, but the police officer that testified said that when they took over, that he was sort of pacing back and forth and saying, you know, why did she have this surgery? She didn't need to have this surgery. Why did she do this? She's taking all these drugs. So he seemed out of control, and what the police officer said Friday was that he became concerned that he would have to, you know, restrain Mr. McNeil because he was so agitated and worked up. The defense did point out, however, that this is the first time that this police officer has ever said that. He did not testify. That was not in his police report, and he did not testify to that in the preliminary hearing. He gave no previous indication that he felt Mr. McNeil was that out of control, that he would become sort of a reason to be concerned about the safety of the other people in the room. So
what?
Well, so, Michael?
I mean, you know.
I'm telling you, that's not a little thing, I don't think. I was just thinking about this, Jennifer, and I don't know if you read the comments after some of your stories on your newspaper and on the Salt Lake Tribune. There's a lot of people on there, and, you know, it could be five people posting under different names. It very well could be, but it seems like there's a lot of people who think he's being railroaded. So something that, I swear, Michael, I couldn't believe it either. I'm like, wow. Really surprised me.
There is a whole string of suspicious deaths in Martin McNeil's past.
That is true. The Deseret News investigation, you know, they spent a year, Sarah Lentz and Brian West spent a year looking at McNeil. And found that, yes, there is a whole bunch of people in his immediate family who have died in circumstances that seem suspicious or strange or unusual in the past. No charges have ever been filed against him in any of those situations. You know, the defense will argue that this is a highly circumstantial case. There is no homicide finding from any expert, including the paid expert for the state, and you know, they believe that he has a solid alibi. And again, it might be one of those situations where only two people really know, and one of them isn't here to say. It's just we'll have to see what the jury thinks after, you know, 5 weeks of testimony. Now, one new thing that we heard this week is that in the prosecutor's opening statements is that there are at least three or four inmates who have been served time with Martin in one place or another. Well, probably would have been federal prison because it was after Michelle's death, who claim that he told them in one form or the other that no one could ever prove that she died, you know, from anything but an accident. He doesn't admit to anything in particular in those conversations, at least in the way they're characterized, you know, by the defense at this point. But there may be some interesting testimony to come from these individuals who claim that he said things in prison that suggest that he had something to do with it.
We're talking with Jennifer Dobner. Jennifer is a writer for the Deseret News. She is reporting on the Martin McNeil murder trial, and we're not going to call him doctor anymore because he did turn in his medical license, and so he's just Martin to us now. He is charged with killing his wife, Michelle, in 2007. The circumstances surrounding this murder, reads like a movie script, that you wouldn't believe. It would have to be fiction. And at the center of this case is a woman named Gypsy Willis, who the prosecution believes was the person and the reason why McNeil decided to kill his wife. He was having a raging affair with her and moved her into the house shortly after Michelle died. I mean, all the ugly stuff. We've seen all of this before. We've heard it all before, but in different cases and different parts. In this McNeil case, it's all brought together. So now we have the EMTs doing CPR, and she's has water and liquid coming out of her mouth. She had smears on her nose, and if the doctor had been doing CPR correctly, he would have had it on his face. People are going to testify that they did not see her chest rise up and go down. They're going to testify that he was faking it, basically. So now they take her in the ambulance. They go to the hospital. How does the doctor act? Do we know what happened there?
He went in the ambulance with her to the hospital, and we haven't really heard, we haven't heard any testimony from the emergency room physicians or any of the staff there yet. All we've heard is from the neighbors at this point and the police officer. So I don't know if his erratic behavior or outburst continued at the hospital.
Do we know if Michelle was ever revived, Jennifer?
She was not. And in fact, she had no pulse. The police officer said she had no pulse at any time that they were working on her. Even when her collar seemed to improve and she expelled the water from her chest cavity, there was no pulse. So
and one of her wounds on her face even started bleeding, which indicated that at least blood was being pumped.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She had a number of incisions in her hairline and near her ears because she had a full facelift, and the neighbors did say that they saw those, that they could see that those wounds began to bleed a little bit as they were participating in the CPR.
So her heart was going, but they can never get the heartbeat up and the pulse. What about McNeil as a neighbor? Was he well-liked in the neighborhood? Did they give any indication of whether he was or not?
You know, it doesn't sound like the family was particularly friendly with their neighbors, like not having, you know, backyard barbecues and things like that. In fact, one of the neighbors said she'd not ever been inside their house before. They had lived there, I think they said, for about 2 years at the time that this happened. But they did all attend the same church together.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin was a Sunday school teacher at their Mormon congregation. And he had talked publicly about some of his health problems that he was having.
Can we talk about that, Jennifer? What was the deal with, first of all, in the Army, he got himself discharged by lying about having schizophrenia.
Right.
And he was able to get his veterans benefits and Social Security disability up until 2010, even as he practiced as a doctor.
That is correct.
Couldn't there be federal charges brought against him for fraud against the Veterans Administration and Social Security? That's a separate question. But then the whole lie about the foot cancer. What was he hoping to gain by claiming to have cancer that he didn't have? What's the story there? Do we know yet?
Well, I don't know the name of the condition, but the defense attorneys have said that he does have some sort of foot-toe condition, some sort of ailment, that he's had 3 surgeries, that he has been worn. At some time in the neighborhood, they saw him wearing a boot, you know, sort of one of those heavy plastic walking boot things that you have when you have foot problems, and mm-hmm. that he sometimes needed to use a cane because he was experiencing a lot of discomfort and pain. In court Friday, the neighbors testified that he said that he had cancer and that the prognosis was not good at the time that he gave the talk in church. He said, you know, maybe 6 months to a year. That seemed to have dissipated. And Doug Daniels, one of the neighbor who helped him get Michelle out of the tub, said that he asked Martin periodically about how things were going, and Martin was not very specific in his answers, but said, you know, oh, well, I'm doing a little better, or I'm going to have another procedure, and those were the kind of responses that he gave whenever he was asked about his foot problem. So I expect we'll hear from the defense more specific information about that, but that's pretty much all we've been told at this time.
Oh, my goodness.
What do you think about my thoughts about the veteran and Social Security fraud?
I suppose it's possible, but I do not know whether or not he has an actual diagnosed condition. There is some suggestion that at least one of his biological daughters has some mental health issues, and it may be that Mr. McNeil does as well. I don't know. That I've never heard it discussed that he had a diagnosed. I mean, beyond the latent schizophrenia stuff that we hear was, faked when he was in the Army, I don't know if there's any evidence that suggests otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We have a question from the chat room about Gypsy Willis. How old is she compared to Michelle? Is she quite a bit younger?
I don't know that I've ever seen her age in any of the stories.
And I was thinking that myself, because I was looking at my notes and I thought, I can't believe it, and put her age down, but I don't know if I've read that anywhere.
If I was sitting in front of my computer, which I am not, I could check the court system because her birthday might be on the criminal charges, but, I don't know how old she is. And
how old does she look? Let's put it that way.
Well, in the photograph that I have of her, she looks like she might be in her late 30s to her early 40s.
Mm-hmm. So I
don't know.
Yeah. And when is she going to testify? When is Gypsy Willis going to testify? Do we know yet?
We're sort of hearing that it might be as early as this Friday.
Okay. And what is the crowd like down at the, is it standing room only or no standing room, or is it just out of, just people lining up around the block trying to get a good seat, or is it a circus atmosphere now?
It was a bit of a circus the first day or so because there's a lot of national media attention. The Nancy Grace show was here. There's a group from Japan that is here. There are seats in the courtroom.
Okay.
It is the first trial in Utah to be
televised. I didn't know.
Televised.
In fact, I convinced Michael. I said, Michael, there's no way. That was ruled by the Utah Supreme Court. They've tried for years. They'll never have cameras in the courtroom. Not going to happen. And he calls me. He's like, oh, you're wrong. And I'm like, no, I'm not wrong. Just shut up and leave me alone. And I was absolutely wrong. I had no idea that had been overturned. It was just recently overturned, right?
Yeah, they did it by judicial rule, and it's only been used, I think this is the first trial, so it's been a limited practice at this point. And I think that, we'll see how it works from the court's perspective, but it's very interesting. There's a room set up off the courtroom that media is using where some of the equipment is set up, and there's a TV monitor in there, and I spent part of the day Friday sitting in there instead of sitting in the courtroom to just sort of get a sense of, how that changes, what the vantage point is. And I actually preferred it because there are two cameras. One is on a bookcase sort of behind the defense, and it provides a better shot of the
stand.
My husband is asking me a question.
No.
He wants his dinner. So it provides a good, tight, sort of view of the judge's face and also of the defense. Of the witnesses. And then the other camera is on the right in front of the judge's, where he sits, and it point, and so it gets a good, tight camera on the defense table and on the prosecutors, and some, we've been able to see some things, see Martin's face close up. If you're sitting in the gallery behind, you're looking at the back of everyone's head most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found it really interesting to be able to see him and watch his expression. He doesn't have a lot of expression, but when they were playing the 911 tape, his eyes were look a little bit red, and they got quite watery as he was listening to the 911 tape. So
when you say judicial review about cameras in the courtroom, what does that mean?
It's just a judicial rule. They didn't have to pass a law. It's just a practice. They just establish new rules for what can happen inside a courtroom.
So they can change it.
Still cameras. They can change it back if they decide. Yeah, we've always had still cameras for a long time. The Utah Supreme Court and the appellate court do sometimes allow one video, you know, television camera in a pool situation where one news outlet, you know, takes the footage and then provides it to everyone. That's happened in the last couple of years, occasionally on big high-profile things. But in terms of regular sort of courtroom access, that's not happened before. So this is a bit of an experiment. They've changed the judicial rule to allow for it. Whether or not they continue to allow for it will I think, a lot depend on how this goes.
On how people
behave. But from
behave
my perspective, from my perspective, I mean, I think technically there were some, you know, things to work out, like where could a camera go and, you know, sort of the logistics of it that have created a little more work for the court administrator down there in Provo. But from my perspective, being able to see the witnesses up close and to see Mr. McNeil's face up close, it has been very interesting.
What give us your thoughts on that? What have you observed in the courtroom that perhaps we wouldn't be able to see?
Well, as I said, if you're sitting in the gallery, you know, you're looking at the back of the heads of most of the defense and of most of the and you get a partial view, depending on where you can get a seat, you get a partial view of their interaction with their client, but it's not like they're facing you all the time. So being able to see it through the television camera, you can sometimes see, you know, if the camera's just looking at his face, you can see his expressions more closely. I could see that during the 911 call, his eyes were watering up on Friday. And, you know, I couldn't see that if I was sitting in the gallery.
Right.
They have the first row behind. The first row is for media. But you're still, so you know, you're maybe 8 or 10 feet away, but still you just don't get as much as when you have that camera zooming in on his face.
And
I have a question, Trish.
Go for it, Michael. Go for it.
Well, I would like to know if Jennifer's perception of the two sides. Were you there for opening statements? And so far, I know it's very early in the trial, but who are you impressed? Are the prosecutors as impressive as, say, Juan Martinez in the Jody Arias trial? And is the defense, or who do you think has an advantage, or do you think they're all very capable, or how would you?
Well, I do think they're all very capable, and I will say that Randall Spencer and Suzanne Gustin, who are the defense attorneys, have terrific reputations. They're doing the case pro bono, I'm told. But they're really good, experienced attorneys. And Suzanne did the openings, and she was quite dynamic and very engaging. The defense, I mean, the prosecutors are also very capable. You know, they do this every day. I would say their opening was a little more like a book report. You know, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. So it was less of a narrative and more of a, you know, an accounting of the facts of the case as they see it. But I would say,
so
again,
not terribly, you know, impassioned.
Well, that's a personality thing, and so I wouldn't say as impassioned as Suzanne appears. But I will say this again. There is no finding that this is a homicide, so I think that probably gives the jury a lot to think about.
That's going to be difficult, I think, to prove, because people are loath to, I mean, look at the Casey Anthony trial. It was all circumstantial, and she walked, you know?
Well, and to say nothing of the nearly 200 people exonerated from death row in the past, 10 years for actual innocence, because there is a possibility, certainly, that someone will believe, you know, that there's reasonable doubt, and it has to be a unanimous decision, of course, in order to have a conviction. It's a 6-man, 5-woman jury. 3 of those people are alternates, and I can't recall off the top of my head which of the 11 were the last 3 called. I can't remember if they're men or women, but they are.
Wait a minute. So the jurors and the juries in Utah consist of 8? The deliberating jury is of 8?
It is 8 in this case. It is not. Sometimes it's 12, but in this case it is 8. And there's 3 alternates. And so they'll be there for everything, and then they will not be part of the deliberations unless they're needed, of course. They are taking a lot of notes. And this judge, Derek Pullen, does allow juries to ask questions. So here's how that works.
Wonderful.
So when it's very interesting because I've never been in a courtroom where this has happened before, and it's very interesting because they sort of cut to the chase, right? They don't, to some degree, don't care so much about someone's legal argument. They have more practical questions sometimes, and so after a witness testifies, the judge then asks the jury if anybody has any questions. They raise their hand, they write their question down, and then the judge reviews the question with the prosecutor and the defense attorney, and then the judge asks the question of the witness. And so that's been really interesting because it just adds another, piece of information that or sometimes it's been the same question sort of asked in a different way. But it has been, I think, quite interesting. So,
and so far, of course, the questions haven't given us a clue really as to how the jury is leaning. But as we get into the meat of this trial, as in the Arias case, it was very clear that there were people not believing Arias' story. And so I'm assuming we'll be able to really get a feel for how this jury is handling the evidence.
Maybe. I mean, I think I've covered a lot of cases where I thought, wow, this really could be an acquittal, and then in fact, the jury doesn't buy it. And so it's up to them. That's the beauty of the system.
And what is the makeup of the jury again, Jennifer? How many women, men?
Yeah. Six men and five women, all ages. They all appear to be white. No blacks or Hispanics no ethnicity. But there's a young woman who's probably in her 20s. There's several who look like they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Maybe one pushing 60. Late 60s to early 70s. So it's across the age demographic clearly and. It will be interesting. They brought in about over 100 people to screen for the jury selection process. They called about 100 and somewhere between 110 and 120. They 10 days before they asked them to come in and fill out a questionnaire. It was 185 questions, if I remember correctly, 22 pages. A lot of it was really standard stuff, like have you ever been convicted of a crime or has any of your family been convicted of a crime? How do you feel about law enforcement? Do you trust the police? Are you suspicious of the police? Fairly standard sort of voir dire questions. Then there was a couple of questions in there about whether or not you know anyone who has had a facelift and what your opinions were of plastic surgery. There were questions about sexual infidelity and whether or not you had opinions about that would prohibit you from being, unbiased. And then from that, it was a two-day process. So they questioned every single juror and then individually in the judge's chambers before making their decision. And then this is the group that was selected. So
it went really quickly for a trial of this magnitude, I thought.
Well, the first day it was pretty slow. They only got through like 35 people, and we all went, "Oh no!" But the second day was a little more efficient, and I think they kind of worked the kinks out through those first 30 people or so, and then they moved a lot quicker. We were in court till about 6:30 on the night before. Opening statements were Thursday, so Wednesday night we were there till about 6:30. They started at 8:30 that morning. So, it was a full day and a half of getting the jury picked. But it'll be really interesting to see how their questions, what their questions are going forward and, whether or not that gives us any insight to what they're thinking. Because,
I think
again,
it'll give
only takes one person.
Right,
say,
I think it'll give us great insight. It'll take
what
one person
the
what?
Hours of... What are the hours of the, when do they take a break in the morning? So the court starts at 8:30, it goes till when, and then they have a break, and then they take a lunch.
Court starts at 8:30, and usually somewhere in the you know, 10 to 11 o'clock hour, they take a 15-minute break, and then they'll go till 12 or 12:15, sometimes 12:30. They're trying to do it at a natural break, you know, like with a witness, you know, it might, they might break when the prosecutor stops asking questions and then pick up cross after the break or pick up in cross-examination, you know, after lunch. They're trying not to interrupt anybody in the middle of their testimony so far. Court's ending between, the target is 3 o'clock, but it's been 3, and it's been like 3:15, 3:30 the last couple of days. So, and it's Tuesday through Friday. And I think that in the Salt Lake area, well, really anywhere, on the websites, I believe, of the KUTV Channel 2 and KTV, I can't remember the call letters, for KSTU, Fox 13 News here, I think they're both streaming the video from the courtroom live, so people really anywhere could log on to that and take a look. And then the video is also showing up on the Nancy Grace Show every night, and I think that CNN is also doing daily reports from this trial, so they can watch.
And Wild About Trial also streams it.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
So I and so I, you know, it'd be interesting to know what people think out there think about what they're seeing. This week we are expecting to hear from Ada and Rachel and Alexis, three of the daughters, and that should provide some really interesting testimony.
In one of the articles I read, Jennifer, it said Rachel testified that Ada is actually Vanessa's daughter that they were raising as their own.
I haven't seen that, and it's not in any of the things that the Deseret News has reported, I don't think. And I don't know who Vanessa is. Do you have more information about that?
Let me see. It was one of the daughters. Maybe I'm saying the wrong thing. Was it Valerie? Is there a Valerie?
Mm-mm. No.
Let me see.
Alexis. And Rachel, hang on, I've got a huge pile of research, and
hi,
everything's in my brain.
Can you hear me?
Is that Ada?
Oh,
Vanessa's daughter. Yeah, Vanessa's daughter.
Hi, can you guys hear me now?
Well, I can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I was kicked
you.
Off. Did anybody notice I was kicked off for like 5 minutes?
Well,
no,
I didn't hear you talking, but I didn't know you were kicked off. So
nobody loves
couple,
me.
Here,
continue.
Here's that's not true. So here's what we know. Here's what this says. This says their biological children are Rachel, Vanessa, Alexis, and Damien, and then their adopted children are Giselle, Sabrina, Elle, and Ada.
Because I'm reading here, daughter Rachel McNeil testified that Ada, who everyone knows as one of the McNeil's adopted daughters, is actually the McNeil's biological granddaughter. Ada is Vanessa's daughter.
Where are you reading
that,
Michael?
Where are you reading that?
I am reading that on, I'm going up, it's on Stark's Twitter, Stark393.
Okay, you know what? No, you know what? Dial that back in, and I'll explain later, okay? Dial that, yeah.
Well, it's saying that she testified to it in one of the previous trials, and I'm assuming it was the one about using the daughter's identity, so we can check.
Check the transcript. Absolutely. Okay,
that's,
you know what?
Explosive.
Jennifer? I know I told you it'd take about an hour and we're longer. Mm-hmm. I do apologize for that, but I'm hoping you will come back real soon. Maybe even not next week, I'm booked up, but maybe the week after, we'll see what's going on. I'm going to try and make it down to the trial next week, so maybe we can connect up and meet up there, but I definitely want to sit in and see what's going on. I'm glad to hear there are seats there, thank goodness. So
So let me know coming, and I'd be happy to come back. We've got 4 weeks of testimony ahead, and then, you know, how many days of jury deliberation, we don't know. But
exactly. Michael, do you have any follow-up? Oh, go ahead.
I just wanted to know, do you feel like the judge has good control of the court? Does she rein in?
Oh.
Are there a lot of objections, and is she
there
moving on them right away, or are there sidebars galore, or?
Well, I think I am really impressed by him. He's been actually quite complimentary of the attorneys for their level of preparedness and their level of civility. They work together frequently, but they really do seem to be very cooperative, the two sides, with each other in terms of sharing information and exhibits and things like that, and working out, you know, stipulations to different types of evidence ahead of time. I thought there would be a pretty big objection to by the defense to bringing the bathtub in. That was the prosecution's, you know, idea. But they actually said they thought it would be really helpful so that people could, as a demonstrative tool, you know, see what we're talking about here in terms of size and scope. And the judges, there are a lot of objections. The defense is clearly winning some of them. I think the judge is keeping the court moving, and he's doing a great job. So
great.
Good. That's
great.
Very good. And we can watch it. I'm not sure if it's on HLN, but it's on wildabouttrial.com. You can watch it there, which is where our wonderful friend Beth Karras is now working and contributing to. So, Michael, final chance for any questions. We don't have any questions left in the chat room. And do you have anything else, Michael, to wrap it up?
But I'd love to thank Jennifer for coming and being our eyes and ears and source for all of this wonderful stuff. I appreciate you so much, Jennifer, and it's been a pleasure, and I do hope you'll come back.
Oh,
she's going to come back.
She has no choice. That's not an option for her to decide. She's coming back. And, Michael, thank you for all your help. I appreciate it. A lot of people don't know that Michael does help me quite a bit off the air, so thank you very much, Mr. Michael. We'll be in touch very soon. And thank you, Jennifer, again, Jennifer Dobner, Deseret News. You can read her wonderful reporting there. You can check it out on websleuths.com in the McNeil trial thread that we have going. I've posted some of her articles there. And, Jennifer, thank you very much. We do greatly appreciate you coming on, and we'll have you on again real soon, okay?
Happy to do it. Be well, both of you.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Hey, and Michael, let me just tell you what we have next week. Oh, I know. Wasn't she great?
Yeah, that was fun. There's so much to this case that I wish we could just banter about, and the previous allegations. And
I know.
Good stuff.
It's crazy. We can talk about whatever the heck we want. And here's the thing. You know, when I ask somebody on that I've never met or really spoken to, I have no idea how it's going to go. And it can go either way. But, boy, she was fantastic. Better than, I knew she'd be good. She was absolutely fantastic. So we will have Jennifer on again.
Too.
Hey,
yeah,
Michael.
I liked her a lot.
Guess who we have on next week? Let me tell you. That's right. Beth Karras is going to join us. She is going to be working on a charity that she will tell us all about, and we'll, I'm sure, talk about the McNeil case as well and everything else that's going on Wild About Trial. We'll also talk about Darlene and Terry Anderson. They were murdered 8 years ago this month. We're going to have their daughter Sherry on to talk about that very sad anniversary and if there's anything going on in her parents' cold case. And in a few weeks, this is really interesting. If you're our age, you know, 40s, 50s, and maybe older, you'll remember a movie called Yours, Mine, and Ours. Do you remember that, Michael, with Lucille Ball?
Absolutely. Henry Fonda, yep.
Yes. Okay. One of the kids that movie was based on has written a book, and Yours, Mine, and Ours in the movie, nothing like the real home life. There was abuse, sexual abuse, horrendous. Terrible things going on in that family, and that whole Hollywood movie was absolutely a farce. And he's written a book. He's going to be coming on talking about it. He's going to talk about, how he's out to wipe out child abuse, as we all are, and to get a spotlight on the child abuse. No longer can they hide. And the one thing he's going to talk about, too, Michael, is how transcendental meditation helped him deal with everything. I mean, here he is, you know, one of the subjects of one of the most famous movies ever made, and it's supposed to be from this big, happy family, and in reality, the dad was just horrendous, you know, mom no good. It's just awful. So he does have a happy ending, though.
Oh, that sounds wild. But how, you know, public faces do not tell the true story, and we found that out so many times. look at Bing Crosby, Joan Crawford. I mean, these supposedly idyllic people that come off squeaky clean, and they're tyrants behind the scenes. Love Inside Scoops.
Oh, I do too. And there's a new book out now about Johnny Carson, written by his lawyer, of all people, his lawyer forever. They were dear friends. And basically, according to the book, Johnny Carson said that if they opened up his chest, they wouldn't find a heart. It would just be empty. And his lawyer really paints an unflattering picture of Johnny Carson. But I am too. I'm into
You're
that.
You're kidding. Did you read it?
No. I haven't read the book yet. I just read a few excerpts, and it's ugly. Yeah, I don't want to read it. I like Johnny Carson. He was part of my childhood. I don't want it to destroy that, but it's true. It just seems like, there's so many of these horrible things that go on behind closed doors. And here's the thing. Most of it is none of our business, but if you're abusing a kid, then it's my business. That's how I feel. And that's why the spotlight has to be on child abuse and the abusers, so we can get it to stop. We can stop that circle of abuse if everybody pitches in and does the right thing. Okay, Michael, are you ready to get gooed one more time?
I'm going to hang up.
Okay. You hang up.
I know the goo.
You know the goo. It's the legal goo, my friends. The opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and do remember this. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and from ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, if you get your true crime brain in just a frenzy because you're so angry, you come to me. You don't take it out on the forums, okay? It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.